Vayehi bayom hashemini kara Moshe liaharon ulvanav ulziknei Yisrael. It was on the eighth day Moshe summoned Aharon and his sons and the elders of Israel. ... Vayedaber Adonai el Moshe v'el Aharon lemor, Zos chukas ha-Torah, asher tzivo Adonai lemor, Daber el b'nei Yisrael, v'yikhu eilech afara aduma timima, Asher ein bahmum asher lo Allah aleha'ol. Hashem spoke to Moshe and to Aharon, saying, "This is the decree of the Torah, which Hashem has commanded, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and they shall take to you a completely red cow, which is without blemish, and upon which a yoke has not come." OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I am your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for the double Parsha, Shabbat Parshat Shemini, and Parshat Parah. That means we take out two Torahs this Shabbat. We read the regular weekly portion of Shemini for seven people in the first Torah, and then instead of the usual maftir of Shemini, we read the maftir called Parah, which comes from Parshat Chukat, a little piece of trivia that I discovered, which I don't know what significance it has. But Parshat Shemini and the entire Parsha of Chukat, from which Parshat Parah comes, those two sedras have exactly the same number of letters. Interesting fact. And that's the story. We'll talk more about both. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 21st of Adar Sheni, 5776, corresponding to the last day of March in the year 2016. That would be March 31st. So tomorrow is April 1st, also known as April Fool's Day, but that's not very Jewish thing. What is Jewish is that this evening is the eve of the 22nd of Adar Sheni, etc., etc. Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai, Adonai Shimava Koli, Tichyena Oznecha Kashuvot Lekol Tachanunai. Imavono Tishmorya Adonai Miya Amod, Ki Imacha Hasalicha Lema'an Tivare, Kiviti Adonai Kivata Navshi Velidvaro Hochalti, Navshi L'Adonai Mi Shomerim LaBoker, Shomerim LaBoker, Yachel Yisrael El Adonai Ki Im Adonai HaChesed V'Harbe Imo Fedut, V'Hu Yifde Et Yisrael Mikol Avonotav. Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael Hanetunim Batzara Uvashivya Ha'omidim Bein Bayam Uvein Bayabasha Hamakom Yirachem Aleihem V'Yotzieim Mitzara Lirvacha U'Me'afela L'Ora U'Mishibud L'Geula Hashta Ba'Agala U'Vizman Kariv V'Nomar Amen. You know, many times in the past when I would say Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael on this show, I would mention that first and foremost in my mind, among many others, unfortunately, and people whose names I don't know, just groups of people. But first and foremost in my mind had always been Jonathan Pollard, because to me that's a classic example of a fellow Jew who is a hero of Israel. He did very, very important things for his fellow Jews and for Israel, and he got messed up. I could use other words, but I don't know which ones are acceptable on the air. Many, many times over, treated extremely poorly by the United States and by the State of Israel. And when he was released from prison, until he was released from prison, I had been in Torah Tidbits writing the name Jonathan Pollard and mentioned 10,956 days in jail, in prison, and then the website www.jonathanpollard.org. And since then, I have not got rid of that, Instead, I write 10,956 plus 133 asterisk days imprisoned. And that is because the conditions of his parole are so restrictive that his imprisonment has continued to this very day and continues. There are hearings pending to waive or get rid of these restrictions, but he has some unusual restrictions that, in essence, have continued his imprisonment outside the walls of the prison in conditions that are not that much better. So I still think of him when I say Achinu Kol Beit Yisrael and other fellow Jews who are in difficult straits, and may God help all of them to come from darkness to light, and in the special case of Jonathan Pollard, to come from his exile to his home, which is here in Israel, which he longs for greatly, but not enough to make him a flight risk, as the parole board seems to indicate. Okay. The Purim season is over, and the Pesach season immediately takes over, and that means Pesach is coming soon, a lot sooner than some people think. It is really, really right around the corner or down the street, however you want to put it. We will bench Rosh Chodesh this Shabbat and say that Rosh Chodesh Nisan will be next Shabbat. And Rosh Chodesh Nisan begins the two-week countdown to Pesach. A lot of things that individuals and families and organizations need to take care of as Pesach approaches. And from our perspective on Torah Tidbits Audio, we will be hopefully enhancing Pesach by Divrei Torah and ideas which you can share and apply. But for this Shabbat, we have, as I said earlier, Parshat Shmini and Parshat Porah. Interesting common thread between the two sedras, aside from the fact, the two readings, I mean, aside from the fact, as I mentioned, that Shmini and Chukat have the same number of letters, which is kind of unusual, is the cow. The Parsha begins, or really continues, the treatment of korbanot, animal sacrifices, and other offerings in the Beit HaMikdash, which was the theme of Vayikra and Sav, and half, we'll say, of Shemini. Two and a half sedras at the beginning of the book of Vayikra that dealt with many, many facets of korbanot and many types of korbanot. And what you have in Shemini is the inauguration period is over. That was a seven-day period. This is the eighth day. And you have the beginning of the functioning of the Mishkan, the temporary tabernacle, as it's called in English, that is the precursor of the Beit HaMikdash as yet in the future at this point in the Torah reading. And you have right away the record of a tragedy that sort of colored and spoiled the celebration of the beginning of the Mishkan, and that is the deaths of the two older sons of Aharon HaKohen, Nadav and Avihu, who brought an offering with their enthusiasm, but did not follow proper procedure, and they brought what the Torah calls an Esh Zara, a strange fire, and they were struck dead. And it's a very poignant portion in the Torah. It's reflected upon from Parshat Acharei, which is the Torah reading also of Yom Kippur, where the service of the Yom Kippur day, let's call it the most special of the service in the Beit HaMikdash, is introduced to us in the Torah with Acharei Mot Shnei V'nei Aharon, that God told Aharon after the deaths of his two sons, saying, and then the Parsha continues. But back to Shmini, we have the culmination of 2.5 sedras where the main theme has been korbanot, offerings, and then you have, and these are the animals you're allowed to eat, these are the fish you're allowed to eat, and the birds you may not eat, and you could eat the other birds, etc., which makes a statement. The statement is that human use of animals is restricted, or let's put it a little differently. A human being, humankind, have a position in the pyramid of nature that gives them top billing, and fact, they use the animal world and the plant world for their own satisfaction, for feeding, for clothing, and for many, many other things. One should never think that this is just a free pass, that people can do anything they want with animals, which many people think. And, of course, there are many people who think definitely not, and they go maybe overboard in the other direction, and maybe we'll touch upon that also. But basically, the Torah way of life is a recognition that animals are there to serve human beings, that the first use of animals discussed, and historically, in the history of the world, was for sacred purposes. I referred to the fact that before Noah, in the antediluvian, love to use that word when it fits, before the flood era, which was 1600 years or something like that, humans were not allowed to eat meat or not allowed to kill for meat. I think they were allowed to eat the equivalent of roadkill. I'm not sure about that. But they weren't allowed to kill an animal to eat until Noah, after the flood, coming out of the ark, offered as sacrifices to God from the kosher animals, as he had been designated to take in 7 pairs of each, and not just 1 pair, male and female, but 7. And after he made these offerings to God, he was given permission to eat meat, provided that he kills the animal and not take limb from a living animal. That was and is still the one kosher-related rule that Judaism claims or states that is incumbent upon all people of the world. In other words, which animals you're allowed to eat and which you're not allowed to eat, that's a Jewish thing from the Torah. How you kill the animal and how you're not allowed to kill it, that's a Jewish thing. How you prepare the meat of an animal to eat, and the separation of milk and meat, and various and sundry other rules that apply to the eating of meat, that's all part of Torah, which was given to the Jewish people. The one universal law related to food is called Eiver min hachai, limb from a living animal, which requires that the animal be killed, dead, including stopping twitching after any kind of slaughter, but no specific method of slaughter and no other restrictions. Perhaps cruelty to animals is also incumbent on all peoples, which means that the method of slaughter need to be humane, but it doesn't need to be as detailed as ritual slaughter of the Jewish people, ritual slaughter that is followed by the Jewish people, has many, many details, but regularly doesn't have to be like that. So again, you have Noah sacrifices to God, then has permission to eat. The Torah presents the laws of sacrifices first, and then presents the section in this week's Parsha of Shemini to tell us what we're allowed to eat and what we're not allowed to eat. So too in the oral law, which is embodied first and foremost in the Mishnah and the Gemara, known as the Talmud, and in Masechet Seder Kodashim, the order of sacred. We start with two volumes called Zevachim, animal sacrifices, Minachot, offerings from other, from the plant world, of flour and olive oil and wine and barley sometimes, and the certain spices that are included. So you have animal kingdom, plant kingdom, offerings in the Beit HaMikdash, and then Masechet Chulin. Masechet Chulin, that's the tractate of Mishnah and Gemara, which deals with ritual slaughter and soaking and salting and removing of certain blood vessels and removing of the sciatic nerve and its invenerating whatever into the fats in the area, and all the other areas of forbidden foods belong after the sacred is discussed. It conveys a message. The message is that first and foremost, we must serve God, and anything that we take for ourselves must be offered to God in some form or another. Now, this does not mean that a firstborn son is given to God, but the Torah obligates the father to redeem his son in a special ceremony known as Pidyon HaBen, because he is the first. And the firsts are dedicated to God unless we have permission to take them for ourselves, pending various performances of mitzvot. I hope that's not too vague, but we see it in the first fruits, which are called bikurim and are brought to the Beit HaMikdash as a gift to the Kohen on duty. We see it in the form of truma, which is the first of the tithing, which is removed from produce and given to the Kohen. We see it in zeroa, how you say, chazez, roan lechayayim, the parts of a slaughtered animal, which are to be given to a kohen. We see it in several different mitzvot, even, let's say, the growth of grapes. You grow grapes, the first 3 years, you're not allowed to eat the fruits. They are orla. The fourth year, it's netaravai, which is holy, is sacred, and there are procedures of what to be done with it. And only after that do the grapes really become ours, and we're able to press them into wine, etc., etc. So there's a pattern, which is an important pattern. It does not go without saying, it needs to be emphasized, that first and foremost, even water. You like drinking water? We all drink water. And yet, there is a temple service called Nisuch Hamayim, held on the 7 days of Sukkot in the Beit HaMikdash. Same idea. We say to God in prayer, in essence, give us beneficial rain because we need water to live. But know that one of the things we do with water is pour it in libation on the Mizbeach in the Beit HaMikdash for you, so to speak. Just to review a little bit of detail, in mammals, the signs of a kosher animal, an animal which we are allowed to eat from, are split hoof, that's an external symbol, and chewing of the cud, which is based on a ruminant stomach system, which is an internal kind of thing. And cow, goat, and sheep are the three main domesticated animals, and all of their relatives, which are kosher to eat. There are seven named non-domesticated animals, wild animals. That's a little funny term because we're not talking about lions and tigers and bears. We're talking about the deer and the antelope and the chamois and a whole bunch, and the giraffe and a whole bunch of other animals like that, but they're not domesticated. And the interesting thing is, in the presentation in Parshat Shemini, we only have the signs of what makes a kosher animal. We have names of animals which have only one sign and not the other, which are not acceptable. And of course, an animal that doesn't have either sign certainly is not acceptable. And we'll talk a little bit more about this after we switch to the second half. No, in the second half of the show, which is coming up momentarily. So let's say you've been listening to Torah Tibbetz Audio, and we'll be right back with more. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio for Parshat Shemini and Parshat Parah. I didn't mention anything about the opening music piece from the first half, or the second half yet. The first half was an intro to a song called Celebrate by a group called The Eighth Day. So it really fits with Vayihi Bayom HaShemini, and it came to pass on the eighth day. So I put that in. Don't know if I'll have time to play the song or not, but it's a group that I'm not really familiar with, and I would like very much to look into them. The first half here is from an animated show from back in the beginning of the 2000s. Don't know how long it lasted. It was a show called Connie the Cow. I didn't expect anyone to recognize it, so I'm telling it to you right off the bat. And I don't feel too different from the way that I felt when the headline of the printed copy of Torah Tidbits this week is Pondering Elsie's Friend. Elsie the Cow No relation to the Parah Aduma, neither is Kani, but they are cows, and they therefore have some kind of relationship. It's just my light way of presenting a topic that might be heavier than the title sounds, but I decided to go with that piece of music and that with the title. I did find something interesting, trivia-wise, about Elsie the Cow. There's some organization or group of advertisers that pick the top 10 advertising mascots of the 20th century. And Elsie just made it at number 10. Some of the others that are included there were the Jolly Green Giant. Glad to see that he made the list. The Michelin tire guy, the Pillsbury Doughboy, Ronald McDonald, but we won't talk about him, especially since we're talking about kosher and non-kosher food, although there are kosher McDonald's here in Israel, which I personally boycott because there are also non-kosher McDonald's in Israel. But that's another issue. You could agree or not agree. And anyway, Elsie made it there. Connie the Cow, certainly not as identifiable as Elsie, but I didn't have any Elsie music, so I put that on. That's the story. Let me see if I could finish up on a little bit on Shmini and then move into Parah Aduma and that whole issue, because there's a lot to be said. The animals that we eat are pretty much based on, well, we've always eaten them. That's known as masoret or tradition. It is less, let's say, integral in the mammal category. Because when it comes to mammals, we have, does it chew its cud? Does it have a split hoof? Then it's kosher. And it really doesn't matter, according to most opinions, whether we've always eaten it or not. Now, I mention this because scientifically, there are, no, I shouldn't say that. The science doesn't work here, doesn't need to work here. The fact of the matter is there are members of the cow family, and the goat, and the sheep family, and the antelope and deer family. And let's just say they have split hoof, they chew their cud, and there's no question about that. But they were not part of the Jewish culinary experience for thousands of years. So people raise their eyebrows when you hear it. Now, I'm not advocating the marketing of giraffe meat, but let's take giraffe as an example. I told you that in Parshat Shmini, the kosher animals are not named, only four examples of non-kosher in the mammals. In Parshat Re'eh, there are 10 kosher animals that are named. One of them is the zemer, Zayin Mem Resh. According to Rav Aryeh Kaplan in the Living Torah, the Zemer was the giraffe. I don't know if everyone agrees with that, but that's what he claims. So the fact of the matter is that it's well known that giraffes have split hooves. The question about chewing the cud was answered and verified by a group of people, one of whom is a friend of mine, who was invited by the Haifa Zoo when a young giraffe died, and they witnessed or performed or helped out in a postmortem, which allowed them to examine the stomach, and they found that the giraffe was a 100% ruminant cud chewer, split hoof, no question, and it's kosher. Again, I say, the fact that your grandfather and mine and great-great-great-great-grandfathers and grandmothers never ate giraffe, I don't know if anybody eats giraffe, I don't know who eats giraffe, that, according to most opinions, is not the issue. The issue is, it's a mammal, does it have a split hoof, and does it chew its cud? Now, as long as I'm mentioning that, we get into an interesting observation here. A dolphin is considered by biologists and zoologists to be a mammal. It nurses its young with milk. That is the main definition of mammal. And has hair, breathes with lungs. That's not exclusive to mammals, but it certainly doesn't make it fish-like, which breathes through their gills and extract oxygen from the water. A dolphin has to come to the surface every number of minutes in order to breathe. And they are definitely mammals from the perspective of science. Does that mean that they are mammals from the perspective of halakha? And that is a theoretical question, although it does have a practical application. Is a dolphin not kosher because it doesn't have split hooves and chew its cud? Or is it not kosher, which we didn't get to yet, because it doesn't have scales and fins? Fins, of course, it has, but scales it doesn't have. And that's the criteria for fish. So one way or the other, a dolphin is not a kosher animal. And that, by the way, is the reason there was a very big uproar many years ago where tuna fishing was done commercially with nets, and the nets trapped dolphins that swam in the vicinity of the tunas. And there were reports of dolphins being processed along with tunas in producing the tuna that's canned, and that would render it not kosher for Jews. And the level of supervision, kashrut supervision, was challenged because many of these boats go out to sea for a couple of months, and they do all of the filleting and storing and freezing on the ships, and there's no way to inspect kashrut-wise when the fish are brought into port. You need somebody on the boat, and I don't know if that was a practical solution. Anyway, there were also environmentalists and animal rights people that objected to the dolphins being trapped in tuna nets, and things have improved, I think, over the years. And certainly the kashrut supervision has improved to the point where our tuna fish, with a reliable hashgacha, a reliable rabbinic certification, is dolphin free. But that was a question. But anyway, back to the issue. The fact of the matter is that Jewish law views a dolphin as a fish. It's not saying, no, it's not a mammal, no, it doesn't nurse its young, and it's not claiming ignorance of those facts. It's saying that for the purpose of categorizing animals, that which spends its entire life in the water and swims like a fish and looks like a fish is halachically a fish. What difference does it make? Because you can't eat it as a fish and you can't eat it as a mammal, so what's the difference? The difference might be the blood of the animal and the carcass of the animal, whether it gives over, imparts a state of tum'ah, ritual impurity from the carcass of a mammal, or is it not a source of ritual impurity because it is a sea creature? So notice that I changed to sea creature rather than, say, fish, but it is treated in the fish category. Similarly, which also comes up in the Sedra, the bat, the atalef, is the only true flying mammal. And it is a mammal because it nurses its young and it has hair and it doesn't have feathers and whatever. But look up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a bird. It's a bird. It's a bat. Bats fly around. They don't fly exactly the same way as other birds. But classification-wise is one thing, and categorizing them in a context of Jewish law is different, and a bat is listed among the non-kosher birds. Does not mean that the Torah did not know that it nursed its young. The Torah was not giving nursing its young as a criteria to make it into one category. It was flying, having wings, and whatever else. So it's not so simple, and that complicates when there is no masoret, there's no tradition. But let's mention that quickly. Let's first move on to fish, because they're handled after mammals before we get to birds. The fish, the Torah says, scales and fins, and that is in 99% of the cases easily determined. Definition of scales, there are different kinds of scales. I've said on before, definitely on this show and in many other talks that I've given, my story with the shark in biology lab. A shark has scales, but those scales do not qualify to make it a kosher fish because they do not scrape off easily. The scales that the Torah was talking about that render a fish kosher are scales that will easily be removed with a knife and even a fingernail without damaging the underlying skin. A shark's scales are part of its skin, and therefore it is not a kosher fish because it does not have the right kind of scales. More recently, or most recently, we have had an issue with the blue marlin, a game fish, and its scales are not exactly alike most of the scales of the standard kosher fish, but have been determined to be just as kosher. It has fins, it has halachically acceptable scales, and a blue marlin has been deemed to be kosher. There is a long-term discussion and controversy about swordfish and other types of fish. We're not going to get into that now. The next category is birds. And for birds, there are no specifically designated criteria. There is a list of 20, more than 20 types of birds that are not kosher. And the fact is that all the rest of the birds are kosher. Here comes the problem. When the Torah says, Kol orev leminehu, maybe that's not a good example because an orev as a raven is pretty well known. There are many birds on the list that we don't even know their correct translation. There's a subject of machloket. But the complicating question that makes it even more is birds that are not biologically classified together with each other might be considered in the same family. So all we have is family headings, but we don't know if a cardinal or an oriole, to use two baseball teams, belongs to this category or that category, or is a kosher animal. So it turns out, kosher bird, it turns out that as far as birds are concerned, we go by masoret. Masoret means a tradition that can be testified to by people who know what they're talking. When pictures of certain pheasants were shown to elderly Moroccan ritual slaughterers, shochatim. Some of them said, oh, yeah, my grandfather, who was a shochet, used to shecht these kind of birds. Recognize it. That constitutes a masorah to say we have a tradition that it was considered as a kosher bird. There are many, many, many birds that fall between the cracks. They are probably not non-kosher, and we don't have a tradition that they are kosher. So there are halachic ramifications in one way or the other, but let's leave that. I want to get a little bit of time to talk about Parah Aduma. So that's Parshat Shemini. And it's not just an issue of what you eat and what you don't eat. It's an issue also of ritual purity and impurity. And the goal is lahavdil, to distinguish between the kosher and the non-kosher, the acceptable and the non-acceptable, and this goes to a lot of different things also, the sacred and the profane, etc., etc. Okay, Parsha Para, and its, we'll call it partner Parsha, Parsha HaChodesh, next week, are the two pre-Pesach ones. They are related by virtue of the fact that the Para Aduma, the red heifer, needs to be processed in such a way that a potion is prepared which can remove the ritual impurity that a person contracts when he comes into contact with a corpse, with a dead body. Going to mikveh, a ritual bath, is not enough, and there is no way to rid oneself of the tum'ah, called tumat mate, ritual impurity from contact with a corpse, without the potion produced by the Para Aduma, which I'm not going to go into detail. And since Korban Pesach was the number one most popular time of the year, Pesach time, for Jews from all over the country to come to Yerushalayim to take care of korbanot that they owed from inadvertent sin and from other reasons to bring a korban, including voluntary reasons, and hopefully to be part of a group that would have Pesach Seder together, which included the eating of a small portion from a korban Pesach. All of that needed a state of ritual purity, which can only be affected by the Para Aduma. So the portion, 22 verses that we read as the maftir this Shabbat, are about the cow itself, the concept of ritual impurity, specifically from contact with a corpse, and the process of purifying with the potion. That is a precursor to next week's Parsha, which mostly deals with the Korban Pesach, which requires a state of purity, with a very interesting exception, which we could talk about next week if we get there. As you might know, Para Aduma is introduced by a very famous title, Zot Chukat HaTorah. This is the Chok of the Torah. A chok is generally considered to be a mitzvah that does not have logic and common sense to help us understand it all. When you're talking about the mitzvah to give charity to a poor person, that's not a chok. That's something that we understand, easy to understand, and we do it. There are many mitzvot, and this one is like the quintessential example of something that's very enigmatic. Does not mean that we don't have any insights into Para Aduma. We do. We have many. But there's a lot that defies logic. You mean to tell me that when you come into contact with a dead body, you become tameh, ritually impure, and the only way you could become tahor again, in addition to counting 7 days and to going to the mikveh on the last day and waiting for the last day to end, is also to have a potion sprinkled on you on the third day and on the seventh day, that potion being made from the ashes of a red heifer who was slaughtered on Mount of Olives facing the Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount, and prepared in a fire which had a branch of a cedar tree and a lowly hyssop plant and live water from a live spring. And that potion is the only thing that could remove the ritual impurity. What's going on here? No matter what you want to say, it's going to evade straight logical understanding. And the meaning of Zot Chukat HaTorah is that we stand up to the world, the non-Jewish world, and unfortunately the Jewish world as well, who scoff and say, why do you do these kind of silly things? And we say, we do this and we do everything because God commanded it. I understand many things, and I don't understand some things, but that does not determine whether I do it or not. This is a very, very essential element of proper Jewish belief. And unfortunately, that's all the time that I have on this for this show. So I will wish you a Shabbat Shalom. Remember, 2 Sifrei Torah and Rosh Chodesh benching and Lehishtameah.